than concerns. "Everybody needs to take a seat," the doctor announced, hushing the hubbub. "It's very important. Millie, can you get everybody into their seats, please?" Millie nodded.
"What's going on?" asked Charles Anders.
"We're about to arrive at Eternity Terminal Station," said the doctor. There was a flurry of excitement. "I need you all sitting down, please. Now!"
"Do we have to return to our originally designated seats?" somebody asked.
"No, Joyce," replied the doctor. "You can stay right here in executive and make yourself comfortable."
With Sugar and the whirring Follow Me in tow, the doctor returned to the flight deck. He took a seat in the captain's chair and began to review the data on the monitor screens. His fingers moved across the keyboard, entering instructions. An alert notice sounded, and a message window appeared on the main screen. It said, "E-Slam engines decycled, affecting end-stage transposition to Eternity Terminal Station. Search for Eternity Terminal Station quantum beacon? Yes, no." The doctor selected the yes option. On the main screen, the trajectory simulation graphics had altered a great deal. Instead of a sense that they were rushing down a canyon or tunnel, it now seemed to suggest a flat, intermittent path, like a dotted line that meandered lazily but made no dramatic twists. Everything seemed to have become compressed along a horizontal plane. There was another chime, and another message window appeared. This one read, "Eternity Terminal Station Quantum Beacon Identified. Interstitial locators matched and locked. End stage transposition engaging on automatic."
"Is that good?" asked Sugar. "That's good, isn't it?"
"It's very good," the doctor said.
There was another chime. This time the message read, "ETA Eternity Terminal Station 15 seconds. 14. 13. 12.
"Sit down and strap in, Sugar," said the doctor. "We're about to arrive."
Eyes bright, she sat down beside him and rummaged for the restraint. The display continued to count down on screen. It finally reached zero. The moving graphic of the dotted line stopped moving and became a simple blinking cursor. There was absolutely no sensation of arrest or deceleration, no feeling of added or subtracted momentum.
"Are we there yet?" she asked.
"Yes," said the doctor.
"We've stopped moving?"
"Inasmuch as we never were moving, yes," said the doctor.
"How can you tell?"
Sugar asked.
"I can't tell. How can you tell? It doesn't feel any different."
The doctor leaned forward and pressed a control pad on the console. The pink light flickering around the edges of the windows went out.
"Better?"
he asked.
"You see, I always thought," said Sugar, "that there should have been much more going on."
The doctor nodded. He'd told Millie and the passengers to stay put and be patient just a little longer, while he and Sugar took the first look outside. The main hatch didn't seem to want to unlock.
"What do you mean?" he asked, trying a screwdriver again.
"I don't know," she shrugged. "Something dramatic. I mean, this trip is a pretty huge deal. There ought to be flashes and noises and hoopla, not a little pink flickery glow."
He nodded.
"So you're saying there should have been, I don't know, deafening explosions of cosmic lightning, galaxies swirling past like blizzards, violent bucking turbulence and the scream of tortured gravity?"
"At the very least," she agreed.
"Can I just ask," said the doctor, "all things being equal, wasn't this dramatic enough?"
The hatch suddenly shuddered and opened with a wet kiss of releasing hydraulics. Hooters sounded and amber hazard lights cycled and flashed. They felt the touch of cool air against their faces as the interstitial transposition vehicle stopped holding its breath and started to inhale the air outside. Side by side, they stepped through the heavy hatchway lock and out into the open, squinting into the bright daylight. There was a brisk breeze, and it carried with it a vague cocktail of industrial scents, concrete, plastic, exhaust fumes, tar. They looked out across Eternity Terminal Station.
"Hmm," said the doctor. "You know what? I think it's going to keep being dramatic for a while longer."
Except for one small detail, Eternity Terminal Station was exactly as Sugar had pictured it. Directly in front of them, the imposing structure of the terminal station rose against a sky the colour of a halogen light. It was a multi-level, multi-concourse superstructure built in chrome, glass and steel, a massive structure that projected huge bladed towers high into the air. To the left, at the limit of the station zone, lay a long, misty line of gargantuan cradles containing bulk system ships in for repair or maintenance. Beyond the dry docks, the skyline of eternity rose into the haze, a vista of smoky blue spires and burnished domes. Eternity. The furthest of the Empire's great colonies. One of the towering achievements of the human species. Sugar swallowed hard. She had dreamed about this moment and trained hard and won out against all the odds to be part of this event. In the days and weeks running up to departure, she'd speculated wildly about what emotions she would register on arrival. She was canny enough to expect it to be a strange mix, a tearful blend of elation, awe, and confusion. She had known her reaction would probably take her by surprise, but she'd never imagined this. "Where is everybody?" she asked. The landing concourse below them was empty. It was supposed to be a public holiday. The entire population of Eternity Colony was supposed to be turning out to meet them. That's what she'd been told. She could see service and support vehicles waiting at the edge of the concourse and huge temporary stands that had been erected to seat the most important delegates and guests. At the foot of the concrete landing tower steps, an avenue of red carpet had been laid out, stretching all the way to the rostrum in the centre of the concourse from where Joseph Stearns Cluxton, Captain Gupta and other key personnel were supposed to address the assembled masses. There was not a single soul in sight.
"Oh dear," said the Doctor. "Oh no, no, no."
He stepped down off the vehicle's extended ramp onto the platform at the top of the landing tower. He turned and looked back at the vessel he had been travelling in. Dull sunlight glinted off its matte-finished hull. From the outside, the interstitial transposition vehicle looked like a great marine animal, a giant from the depths. It was grey and smooth, its sleek flanks ergonomic rather than streamlined. From the tip of the nose to the swell of the transposition engines, it was 600 metres long. 8 interstitial field generation pods extended from its main body at regular intervals, 4 on each side. The pods were mounted on robust but complex multi-positional arms. The entire vehicle was parked in a purpose-built reception cradle in the middle of the concourse. It looked as if some giant hand had rested it there, as easily as sugar might put a bottle of champagne into a Follow-Me's carry hopper.
"Right place, right time," the Doctor murmured.
He turned on the spot again and then hurried down the steps of the landing tower onto the red carpet. Sugar followed him.
"I don't understand," she said. "Where is everybody?"
Still looking around, the Doctor chewed at his lower lip, thoughtfully, and didn't reply.
"They've disappeared too, haven't they?" Sugar asked. "They've vanished as well, just like everybody else. Everyone's vanished, except for us."
"Let's not be hasty," the Doctor began.
"Oh, just look,"
Sugar moaned, pointing at the rostrum and the seating stands.
"They're supposed to be here. Crowds and crowds of them were supposed to be here, but they're not. So you tell me where they are if they haven't vanished."
He carried on walking down the red carpet and stepped up onto the rostrum. He turned in another full circle and stopped facing the main terminal building.
"Where do we start?" he asked, talking to himself.
He jumped off the rostrum and ran towards the terminal. She ran after him.
"What have you seen?" she asked.
"I'm not sure. There's got to be an answer here somewhere," he replied.
"What is it?" she asked.
"I have no idea," said the Doctor.
She grabbed his arm. He'd heard it as well. The sound of distant voices calling out.
"Oh, not here too," Sugar said.
"No, that's wrong," he said, mainly to himself.
There was a note of exasperation in his voice.
"How can it be here too?" The problem was with the ship, specifically the ship. The transposition engines had become misaligned. The problem should remain with the ship. It shouldn't be out here too.
"Neither should they," said Sugar.
She nodded towards the ship. Millie and several of the passengers were emerging, blinking onto the landing tower.
"Well, we weren't going to keep them on board forever," said the Doctor.
"Let's get everyone off and into one of the seating areas inside the terminal."
"Will they be safe off the ship?" Sugar asked.
"As safe as on it," the Doctor replied.
"Safer, probably." They hurried back towards the ship.
"By the way," said the Doctor, "it's an interstitial transposition vehicle. Even you're calling it a ship now."
"Ha ha," she replied,
without enthusiasm. Millie was waving to them eagerly from the top of the tower.
"Hello, hello," she called. "Where is everybody?"
"Have you noticed something?" asked Lars Bortnick.
He looked up at the sky. It's the same. It's the same as when we arrived.
So what? Asked J. Sylvian. Her eyes were red and puffy. She hadn't stopped crying much since the disappearance of her husband.
We were scheduled to arrive late afternoon local time, said Bortnick, about an hour before sunset. Mr. Cluxton was very precise about the details.
And? Asked Charles Anders.
Well, said Bortnick, we've been here at least 3/4 of an hour, and the sky's still the same. It's not getting darker. The shadows aren't lengthening.
Have you ever been to Eternity before? Monica Westlake asked Bortnick.
No, ma'am, I have not, he replied.
Well, then perhaps things work differently here, she suggested.
A sunset is still a sunset wherever you are, sniffed Lars Bortnick.
And a sigh is still a sigh, said the doctor.
Where have you been? Asked Anders.
Oh, just looking around, the doctor replied. It had taken about 30 minutes to get all the passengers off the vehicle and into one of the vast lounges inside the glass and steel terminal building. The doctor had wanted everybody to stay together, though he had allowed Millie to wander off with Link and Tang in search of food. They'd returned with a snack trolley and an urn of coffee that was, mysteriously, piping hot.
Bortnick is upsetting people, said Anders. He claims it should be dark by now.
It was just an observation, said Bortnick.
It is a puzzle, the doctor agreed.
Something horrible has happened to us, hasn't it?
G. Sylvian asked, and she started to cry again. Mrs. Westlake moved to comfort her.
I was wondering what happened to that man, Bortnick said. What was his name? Reston? What happened to him?
I think everyone should stay here just a little while longer, said the doctor firmly, ignoring both the question and the worried glance that Sugar sent in his direction.
He moved away from the main group as they continued to chatter amongst themselves and stood looking out through one of the terminal building's huge windows at the interstitial transposition vehicle sitting in its cradle.
You don't suppose this is a joke? Asked Sugar, coming up to him. You know, everyone's hiding in a closet and they're all going to jump out suddenly and shout, surprise!
The doctor smiled. He could sense how hard she was trying to stay on top of her nerves.
That certainly would be a very original way of greeting a pioneering voyage, he said.
Do you know what the population of Eternity Colony is?
She shrugged. About 8 billion, I think, she said.
Well, you see, that's a problem. That's a lot of closets.
There's no one here, is there? She asked. He shook his head.
I took a little walk around the terminal while you were getting everybody settled. It's just empty.
I even went out into the city. Not far, mind, just a street or two. There's no one. There's no traffic, no animals, no air traffic either.
And Bortnick's right. It should be getting dark by now.
I keep hearing that sound of voices, said Sugar.
That really worries you, he said.
I've seen what happens when it gets loud, she replied.
No, it's more than that. The noise itself scared you.
Something about your auntie's chimney?
Sugar laughed and shook her head.
Oh, that's nothing, she said. Just a silly thing. Tell me.
When I was a kid, I had to go and stay with my auntie for a few weeks. She had an apartment in the Toronto Tower. You know the Toronto Tower?
Ages since I've been there, said the doctor.
Go on. So I stayed there. It was fine. But on the second night, there was this noise. It seemed to be coming from the wall of my room, right beside my bed. It was like a voice, really shrill. I didn't know what it was. I thought it was calling my name. I was so scared. It gave me nightmares. After a week, I told my auntie about it. I thought she'd think I was being silly. She got maintenance in, and they took the wall panel down, and behind it was the chimney flue from the apartment's heating system. There was a bird trapped in it. A big white bird called a seagull.
I know what a seagull is, said the doctor.
I didn't, she said. I barely knew what a bird was. I mean, you never see them living in the city towers, do you?
No, I suppose not.
This was an actual wild bird. It came from the empty zones outside the towers. They said it must have been looking for food. Somehow a backdraft had sucked it into the heating system and trapped it in my auntie's chimney. They couldn't save it. It had been in there too long. It had just been moving around, calling, trying to get out. That's all it wanted to do. Get out.
He looked at her.
You see, he said, that's twice you've given me a brilliant idea.
What idea? She asked. He had already turned to head back to the main group.
Doctor, wait, she called. He turned to look at her.
What?
I was thinking about Mr. Reston, she said. I was thinking about what he said to you before... Before...
I know.
He asked you a question, Doctor, she said. He asked why you were here, and you never answered him.
I didn't know, I must have.
You didn't.
Oh, well, it's not important.
I told you about my auntie's chimney, she said.
The doctor sighed. All right, Sugar Macaulay. The real truth is, it was an accident. I wander around, see what takes my fancy. I like a good mystery, a good puzzle. That sort of thing usually distracts me. And I arrived on your interstitial transposition vehicle slap bang in the middle of a proper mystery.
You arrived just by chance?
Like a bird accidentally flying into a chimney, the doctor said, smiling.
And the mystery is, why did everybody vanish?
That's part of it, the doctor agreed. You see, Joseph Stern's Cluxton's breakthrough is huge. Quantum transposition is a staggeringly big deal. It should change the face of the human empire forever. It should revolutionize travel between star systems. Transposition technology, well, that's any civilization's ticket to elite major species status. The Cluxton breakthrough is years ahead of its time, decades, centuries. He hesitated. The thing is, he said, 10 years from now, no one will remember it.
What?
I've never heard of him, said the doctor. I've never heard of Joseph Stern's Cluxton. His breakthrough doesn't change things. The Empire goes on for a good long time yet, but transposition technology doesn't catch on. So, something stops it happening. Something occurs, perhaps on this maiden voyage. Something not terribly good. When I found myself on board by accident and discovered what I was in the middle of, I thought I'd try to find out what.
Sugar shook her head. For God's sake, Doctor, you're talking like this is all in the past to you.
The doctor shrugged. Your point?
What, you're from the future? Is that what being a Time Lord means?
Let's just say, replied the doctor, that my relationship with time is not quite as linear as yours. They had reached the seating area where the passengers were waiting.
I've had a bit of an idea, the doctor told them. Actually, Sugar's had a bit of an idea. I'm going to try to find the terminal's main control area. I think it might have some data that will help me crack this problem. I won't be long. I'd like you all to stay here. And no wandering off.
Lars Bortnick rose to his feet.
Now, you see, said the doctor, that's not wandering off already, is it, Mr. Bortnick?
You want to find the central control area? Asked Bortnick. I can take you right there. I've spent the last few months studying Mr. Cluxton's blueprints for this place.
Okay, Mr. Bortnick, you're on, said the doctor. That should save some time. They left the main group at the seating area and walked off through the vast, empty sprawl of the terminal. The Follow Me dutifully zipped along at Sugar's heels. Sugar kept hearing the echo of faraway voices. Bortnick noticed her looking up and assumed she was looking at the sky. That sun's still not setting, he remarked.
So how long have you been Joseph Cluxton's biographer, Mr. Bortnick? Asked the doctor.
3 years now, Bortnick replied. Ever since the breakthrough, really. Noviluna retained me to follow him everywhere, to watch his every move, and to build a thorough and detailed portrait of him.
Wait a minute, said the doctor.
He turned to look at the biographer.
3 years? Are you telling me it's been just 3 years since Cluxton made his breakthrough?
Bortnick nodded. Yes, why?
That's extraordinary, the doctor cried.
The breakthrough is the scientific miracle of our modern age, Bortnick agreed.
No, not that, the doctor said. 3 years. 3 years from theoretical breakthrough to this. There should have been decades of design assimilation and prototype testing. You don't get to that vehicle in just 3 years.
Joseph Stern's Cluxton is a genius, said Bortnick. I don't think you really appreciate...
I think I appreciate more than you imagine, the doctor replied. To have got this far in such a short time, Cluxton must have envisaged the entire transposition process fully formed, right from the start. Either that, or...
Or what? Sugar asked.
What are you suggesting?
Bortnick asked. How much do you know about the breakthrough? The doctor asked him. Bortnick shrugged. Mr. Cluxton has told me a great deal about it, he said. He was working on light-speed drives, the technology on which he built his original fame and fortune. He was running some quantum decay simulations one afternoon, and inspiration hit him. He scribbled down pages of notes right there and then.
In fact, I have most of them copied in facsimile form in my notebook.
Really? Said the doctor. Can I see them?
Bortnick looked extremely dubious. His precious notebook, which he had protested so loudly about mislaying, had eventually been found under the seating nest where the luck dog was gnawing it to death. Bortnick produced the device from his jacket pocket.
I'm rather uncomfortable about this, he explained. This is privileged information, and Mr. Cluxton has entrusted me with it. It's all supposed to be kept out of the public eye until the publication of his exclusive biography.
I'm not the public eye, said the doctor. Oh, come on, Mr. Bortnick, said Sugar.
Bortnick activated the device, thumbed the reader through various screens, and then handed it to the doctor. The doctor studied the notebook screen for a moment, scrolling up and down.
This is amazing, he said.
It is, isn't it? Bortnick agreed.
You claim these are his very first sketches of the transposition process?
I don't claim anything, Doctor, Bortnick replied. That's exactly what Mr. Cluxton told me they were when he gave me copies of them.
But it's so clean, so clear, said the Doctor, still reading.
There are virtually no mistakes or revisions. It's as if the entire mechanism came out perfectly first time.
Yes, that's how it was, said Bortnick.
The Doctor looked at him. Please don't be naive, Mr. Bortnick. He said, I don't care how clever Mr. Cluxton is, or was, no one makes a major theoretical breakthrough in quantum physics and designs the perfect technology to apply it practically in the same afternoon.
Then how do you explain this? Asked Bortnick, petulantly.
Well, said the doctor, Cluxton could have lied to you about the timescale. These could be much later working designs.
Joseph Stearns Cluxton is a man of great integrity, Bortnick protested.
In that case, he must have copied them from somewhere, said Sugar.
The doctor beamed at her. Oh, Sugar Macaulay, good girl.
Occam's razor, Mr. Bortnick, Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is usually the right one.
Bortnick snatched his notebook back. He lurched backwards and Sugar caught him. How dare you? Bortnick demanded. Are you actually suggesting? How dare you? That's slanderous.
Yeah, I was only joking, Doctor, Sugar laughed. After all, where would he copy something like that from?
The doctor's face was very solemn.
Where indeed, he murmured. I think that changes everything.
What do you mean? Sugar asked.
I thought this was one thing, Sugar, he said, but now I'm rather afraid it's something else.
He turned urgently and looked at Bortnick.
It's even more important that I get a look at that control center than it was before, he said.
Bortnick wasn't listening. He was looking up at the roof, distracted.
Do you hear that? He asked. It sounds like someone calling.
Sugar and the doctor looked around. The broad glass and steel spread of the concourse stretched out on either side. They could both hear the faint echo of voices again. It was getting louder.
What is that? Asked Bortnick. He was clearly spooked. I heard it while we were on board.
There's nothing to worry about, said the doctor.
Maybe we should go back, doctor?
Sugar suggested quietly. The doctor nodded. The sound seemed to be coming from ahead of them. Voices, cold and empty, echoed around the empty walls of the terminal.
Yes, that might not be such a bad idea, he said.
Then he hesitated.
Look, he cried. Oh, what's he doing there? Asked Bortnick.
It's that boy, said Sugar.
It was the teenage boy in the holoprint t-shirt. He was about 300 metres ahead of them, beyond a set of large, low sculptures set into the concourse, and much closer to the chrome wall of the central terminal offices.
Lincoln! Lincoln Tang!
The doctor shouted and waved. Lincoln heard him and turned. He waved back cheerfully.
Lincoln! What are you doing? Come here!
The doctor yelled. Lincoln shouted something back, which they didn't quite catch. The air seemed to be dense and very humid suddenly. Sugar's throat felt scratchy. The doctor began to run towards Lincoln. Sugar yelled at him in protest and then started after him. Bortnick, not wishing to be left alone, followed them. The doctor vaulted the lip of one of the odd sculptures and ran right across it to get to Lincoln. The sculpture was a broad, shallow dish of concrete in the shape of a leaf, dry and empty. As he ran across it, the doctor's feet and shins suddenly felt very cold. There was no time to worry about it. The voices were getting louder.
Lincoln! He shouted. Come to me! Come this way!
It's the dog,
Lincoln shouted back.
The little dog's run off.
Never mind, the little dog, the doctor shouted, still running. Come on!
Lincoln hesitated. It was clear that he could suddenly hear the noise of spectral voices too.
He stared at the doctor in confusion. He looked scared. The doctor bounded over the far sill of the odd sculpture and ran towards him, with Sugar close behind him and Bortnick trailing her, blowing hard. The follow me had been forced to skirt around the sculpture and was zooming to catch up with them.
"It's just the little dog," Lincoln said as the doctor ran up to him. "Millie sent me to find some more coffee and I saw the dog running about, so I went after it."
The boy shrugged half-heartedly and his holoprint shirt flickered and changed from sky hockey action to a triumphant sky full of victory fireworks. He gestured behind him. The luck dog sat, panting on the paving slabs behind him, its diamante-trimmed leash trailing. It looked vaguely amused, as if it had been enjoying the chase.
"So what breed is that exactly?" Lincoln asked the doctor.
"I honestly don't think that matters just now," the doctor told him.
"That's a really funny noise," Lincoln remarked.
"Yes, it is," said the doctor. "Listen, we have to move away from here." The boy looked at him sharply.
"Did you just say my name?"
he asked. "Did I what?"
"Did you just say my name?"
Lincoln repeated. Sugar skidded to a halt beside them. "I just heard something call my name too, doctor," she said, making a gesture that seemed to encompass the entire world around them. "They're closing in," said the doctor.
"Who are?"
asked Lincoln. There was a shriek. It made them all jump. It cut clean through the echo of voices circling them. The shriek had come from Bortnick, who had finally caught up with them. He was ashen-faced and pointing with a wobbling finger.
"What in the name of God is that?" he exclaimed.
The doctor knew what he'd seen even before he turned. 10 meters away, an oily, roiling sphere of glassy matter had appeared in mid-air, hovering at chest height. Its mercurial spin increased and it began to swell. Blood leaked into it.
"Here comes another one," murmured Sugar.
"Another what?" exclaimed Bortnick.
"Another what, exactly?"
The glassy extrusion was already becoming a humanoid shape. A hulking shadow form, slope-shouldered and twice the size of a human being. Its head and the extremities of its limbs had yet to coalesce.
"Move, now!" the doctor ordered.
They all turned and ran. The follow me, finally arriving at their location, emitted a whine of protest and shot off after them again. Meanwhile, the luck dog, suddenly robbed of playmates, got up and trotted towards the forming entity. It bounced on its toes and yapped at it. The entity leant down towards it. The luck dog howled and ran in terror. For a little thing, it made rapid progress. It raced straight past Sugar, who had split left around the sculpture. She saw it and instinctively stamped on its trailing leash, bringing it to a sudden and strangulated halt. Sugar bent down, grabbed the leash, scooped the dazed little animal up into her arms, and started running again. The doctor and Lincoln had both cut across the sculpture in their flight.
"Not this way,"
Lincoln suddenly announced. They skidded to a halt halfway across the concrete leaf. Another glassy sphere was spinning into being ahead of them. A second entity was extruding into eternity's quantum wavelength. The doctor and Lincoln broke right.
"What the heck are these things?" Lincoln cried.
"Entities from a parallel quantum position," the doctor yelled back.
"But where are they coming from?"
"I..." the doctor began.
"A parallel quantum position, didn't I make that clear?"
"I haven't got a clue what you're on about,"
Lincoln yelled.
"Wait, wait for me!"
Bortnick shouted. He was hobbling across the big concrete leaf behind them. One of his shoes had apparently come loose.
"Please!"
he yelled.
"Keep going!"
the doctor told Lincoln and turned back for Bortnick. The two semi-formed entities, towering, ominous shadows, were converging on him. They had no feet yet, but the doctor could hear the thump of their footsteps on the concrete.
"They're almost here," he thought. "Almost through. Most of their mass has already solidified in this dimension."
He ran towards the biographer.
"Bortnick, Lars, this way,"
he shouted.
"I can't run anymore,"
Bortnick protested. The noise of shrieking voices had become almost overwhelming. The doctor could hear them calling out from the immeasurable depths of time and space. The voices were calling names.
Lincoln Tang, Sugar McCauley, Lars Bortnick, Lars Bortnick, Lars Bortnick.
"You leave him alone,"
the doctor yelled back.
"You can't have him, you can't have him."
Bortnick ran towards him. A wind had picked up from somewhere, gusting fiercely through the terminal space. A third entity appeared. This one formed in a matter of seconds, as though the more of them that came through, the easier it got. It coalesced right beside Bortnick, blood and shadow swirling out of rotating glass.
"Lars!" the doctor yelled.
The entity reached out and touched Lars Bortnick on the nape of the neck with its unformed hand. Bortnick melted from the neck outwards.
The flesh of his throat, shoulders and head turned to swimming glass, revealing the bones beneath. The transparency travelled down his body, voiding Lars Bortnick, his clothes and his shoes in a swift but indecently vivid anatomical reveal. Bortnick's staring eyes and the ghostly traces of his skull were the last things to vanish. The doctor looked back at him.
"I'm sorry, Lars," he cried. "I'm so, so sorry."
Bortnick, what remained of him, popped and disappeared like a soap bubble on a summer's day. The three entities, almost fully formed now, turned to regard the doctor. The doctor faced them as they lumbered towards him. He pulled out his sonic screwdriver and hastily adjusted its settings. The three entities thumping towards him were in different stages of materialization. The most recent, the thing that had melted Lars Bortnick, was still a glass shape filled with grotesquely vivid organs. The first to form was the most complete. It had the makings of hands now, and feet. Both sported the glass outlines of claws. It had part of its head too. The head was big and hunched forwards, thrusting out from the heavy shoulders. The doctor realised that he could see the line of its mouth hanging in space like the grin of the Cheshire cat about to become real. It was a broad mouth, broader than the terrifying maw of a great white shark, and, like the shark's mouth, this grin was full of teeth. "Not today," the doctor said. "Let's try disrupting your wavelengths a little." He fired a modulated burst from his sonic screwdriver. The three entities shivered as if they were having trouble holding together. The most recently manifested of the three vanished in a wobble of light. The other two devolved rapidly and reduced to shimmering, spinning balls of bloodshot glass. "Sugar! Lincoln, this way!" the doctor yelled. The three of them ran towards the chrome wall. Inside, the central office levels of Eternity Terminal Station were silent and deserted. The terrible howl of voices had, at least temporarily, gone away. The doctor hid behind an operator's desk with Lincoln and Sugar. The luck dog in Sugar's arms yapped excitedly. "Can't you hush him?" the doctor asked. "Not really," she replied. "It's a dog. It doesn't have an off switch."
"Not true of old dogs," the doctor replied. "I once had a dog with an off switch. One click, good night." "That was really cool," Lincoln said.
"What was?" asked the doctor.
"That thing you did with your pen thing,"
said Lincoln.
"You like... banished the monsters, you made them go away. It was like you showed some vampires your holy symbol or something."
"You play a lot of Tri-D games by any chance, Lincoln?" the doctor asked.
"Loads,"
Lincoln nodded.
"So what happened to that Mr. Bortnick? It was like he went all yucky. Something bad happened to him, right?"
The doctor nodded. "Something very bad," he said. The luck dog yapped at him. The doctor patted its head. "Those entities will be back," he said, slowly getting to his feet. "My sonic screwdriver isn't strong enough to disrupt their wavelength for very long." He helped Sugar to her feet. She was still carrying the luck dog in her arms.
"I'm sorry," he said. "This isn't what I thought it was."
"What did you think it was, Doctor?" she asked.
"I thought it was an accident," he said. "I thought your ship had accidentally collided with something during quantum transposition. I thought you'd hit something and it had knocked your engines out of alignment. Like a bird strike hitting a plane. You know what that is?" Sugar and Lincoln shook their heads.
"Like a seagull down your auntie's chimney, then," the doctor said.
"The what?"
asked Lincoln.
"Never mind," said Sugar. "The point is, I thought this was just circumstance," the doctor said. "I thought that Joseph Stearns Cluxton, God bless his cotton socks, had inadvertently invented a transit system that had clashed with another strand of space-time. I thought the entity we encountered, Sugar, was a victim. Something you hit during transposition. Like a goose flying into an air intake. Like a seagull sucked into a chimney. I thought it was an innocent thing trying to get out. Just trying to get out."
"And what is it really?" asked Sugar.
"It's something trying to get in," said the doctor.
"To do what?"
asked Lincoln.
Something bad would be my guess," said the doctor.
"Invade, most likely." "That's all very well," said Lincoln. "But why are my trouser legs damp?"
"My leggings are wet too, Doctor," Sugar said.
The doctor looked down. His pinstripe trousers were soaked from the knee down. Now he understood the chill he'd felt.
"They're fountains!" he exclaimed.
"What are?"
asked Sugar. "Those giant leaf-shaped sculptures out on the concourse," the doctor cried. "They're not giant leaf-shaped sculptures at all. They're fountains. Pools and fountains."
"With no water in them," said Lincoln.
"Not according to our clothes," said the doctor. "We got wet, all of us, running through them. They're full of water, but we can't see it." "How can that be?" asked Sugar. "Because it's moving. You see, the water in the fountain pools is moving, like the air and the sky and the time of day and the people all around us. It's all moving."
"I don't understand," said Lincoln.
"Nobody's vanished," said the doctor. "Nobody at all. They're all still here, but just out of reach, on another wavelength. We're the ones who have vanished." Sugar and Lincoln followed the doctor into the central control room. There were big Novilunar corporate logos on the chrome and glass walls. The luck dog was yapping excitedly in Sugar's arms, and the follow me was chugging along behind her.
"What do you mean?" she asked. "What do you mean, we're the ones who vanished?"
"I mean, that's why everyone on Eternity has disappeared, or seems to have disappeared," said the doctor, sitting down at the nearest console. He looked at her. "They haven't," he said. "We have. Whatever interrupted the ship's transposition knocked us sideways. We're existing at a slightly different wavelength from the reality we know. We've been tilted a few beats sideways, reality-wise."
Sugar blinked. "So everyone who went missing is actually still on that ship?"
"I think so," said the doctor.
"And there are millions of people cheering us outside?" asked Lincoln.
The doctor nodded.
"That's really difficult to get your head around," said Sugar.
"Isn't it?" said the doctor.
"So how do we put it right, then?" asked Lincoln.
"I'm hoping this will tell us," the doctor said, slapping his hands on the surface of the control center's main console. "This station should have mapped the vehicle's entire transposition, plus all superposition variables. The entire flight plan should be here, so I can pick it apart and work out exactly where we were bumped out of reality."
He started to scroll through the monitor data.
"It may take a moment," he added.
"Shame you don't have Bortnick's notebook to help you," said Sugar.
"It is, it really is," the doctor replied. He took the notebook out of his pocket.
"Where did you get that?" Sugar gasped. "Oh, you didn't pick his pocket, did you? The poor man."
The doctor sighed.
"It's what Mr. Bortnick would have wanted," Lincoln stated firmly.
"How do you know?" asked Sugar.
Lincoln shrugged.
"Isn't that what people say at moments like this?"
"Actually, I feel a bit bad about it now, given what, you know, happened to him," the doctor said. "But not so bad that it'll prevent me from using it," he added.
He started to work again, scrolling through complex data on the monitor and comparing it to details on the notebook device. Sugar put the luck dog down and tied its leash to the follow me's basket.
"So let me get this straight," said Lincoln. "First, you thought what happened to us was an accident, but now you don't. You think some kind of alien race, what did you call them?"
"Entities from a parallel quantum position," the doctor said.
"Right. Those things. You reckon they're, like, trying to invade us?"
"Well, it's just supposition on my part," said the doctor. "Because the only way to know for sure is to ask one of those entities, and they don't look like conversational types to me. But I imagine it's something along the lines of this. You have these entities, a hyper-aggressive, predatory species with considerable technological advancement. They inhabit a different reality to ours, a parallel quantum wavelength. Maybe they're simply expansionist in nature, a race of conquerors. Maybe they've used up or worn out their reality and need a new one. Maybe some natural disaster is destroying their universe." "And
we get the idea, Doctor," said Sugar.
"Okay," said the Doctor. "They want to hop into a new reality. Ours looks promising now. They have some basic transposition technology, enough to observe our dimension and maybe send signals through, but not enough to actually open a gateway or transpose themselves into our universe. What they need is someone on our side of things to construct a device that will open the wavelength for them. In order to break through, they need someone to be tunneling from our side to meet them halfway."
"So they sent the details of transposition technology to Joseph Stearns Cluxton," said Sugar.
The doctor grinned and nodded. "They sent the details of transposition technology to good old Joe Cluxton. He probably had no idea where it was coming from. He may have even believed it was his own work. A genius flash of inspiration, anyway. He dutifully built the transposition engines they designed for him and activated them."
"And they started to come through," said Sugar.
"The shock of their transposition shifted things on a quantum level. It jarred us, the three of us and the other people from the ship. It jarred us sideways, just out of step with our reality's quantum wavelength. That's why everybody else appears to have vanished."
"So what are you trying to do?"
asked Lincoln. I'm trying to find a way of jolting us back to the right wavelength so we can rejoin our reality, said the Doctor. And I'm trying to find a way of closing the door on these entities once and for all.
The luck dog started yapping excitedly.
What spooked him? Lincoln asked.
The Doctor looked grim. Like most animals, he's sensitive to things that aren't quite there. He can smell the entities, or hear them at least, because they're gathering. They're closing in. They know what we're trying to do. And they want to stop us.
The Doctor had been working quietly for about 20 minutes. He put his pen down, tore a sheet out of his old-fashioned paper notebook, and looked vaguely pleased with himself. Then he switched off Lars Bortnick's high-tech notebook and slipped it into his pocket.
Have you done it?
Asked Sugar. I've done the theory part, said the Doctor. Now comes the practical. Using the control center's flight record data, I've identified the specific quantum frequency at which we were bumped out of reality.
What do we do with that?
Sugar asked. We get everyone back on board the ship and we cycle the engines up to that frequency again.
That should neatly shift us back into our native quantum environment.
Let's go then, she cried, taking her feet off the console and putting her winged chrome helmet back on.
Lincoln?
Lincoln looked up from another console in the control centre. He'd found out that it was possible to access Tri-D games on it.
Time to leave?
He asked. The Doctor led the way. They moved through the Novilunar complex cautiously, checking each corridor and hall and open space, listening for the sound of beating wings.
You don't seem especially pleased with yourself,
Sugar quietly mentioned to the Doctor as they crept along.
Pleased with myself? He repeated.
Well, haven't you just figured out how to save us? You should be delighted.
I've realised I can't save poor Reston or Lars Bortnick. The entities removed them to their own wavelength. I've no idea how to get them back. I doubt they're still alive anyway.
It's more than that, though, isn't it? She asked.
You're a very perceptive girl, Sugar Macaulay, said the Doctor.
I'm a comfort mediator, she replied. It's my job. So, spill. What's the real problem?
The Doctor sighed.
Well, I just realised that I've already thwarted the entity's plans when we engaged the clutch, Sugar, and when we decycled the engines and brought the ship into land.
Interstitial transposition vehicle, she corrected softly.
That brought a smile to his face, but it was sad too.
That's why they're closing in, he said. That's why they're gathering. We shut the engines down. They still can't get through easily. That's really annoyed them. But, you see, to save everyone, to save you, Sugar, I've got to turn the engines back on.
And that's exactly what they want, she said.
It's a tricky one. I'll say that for it.
What will you do?
Oh, something incredible, he promised. I find that generally works best.
Do I get the impression it will also be entirely spur of the moment and improvised? She asked.
There's nothing wrong with a good ad lib, he replied.
Where have you been?
Demanded Charles Anders when they reappeared.
We haven't been gone long, said the Doctor.
It felt like ages, said J. Sylvian.
We need to get you all back on the vehicle, said Sugar. Millie, can you help me get everyone moving in the right direction?
Yes, Sugar,
Millie called back.
Where's Mr. Bortnick? Asked Mrs. Westlake. Wasn't he with you, Doctor?
Never mind him, protested Charles Anders. I'm not getting back aboard that godforsaken ship. The trip here nearly killed us.
We've got to get back on board it, mister, said Lincoln Tang.
Oh, what do you know? Snapped Anders. You're just a kid.
I know what I'm talking about, old person, Lincoln replied. If we stay here, we'll really be dead. Those things got Mr. Bortnick and he melted something bad.
He what?
Asked Mrs. Westlake.
Melted?
Asked the woman called Joyce.
Oh, my God, said J. Sylvian. Now, Lincoln, said the Doctor, I thought we weren't going to mention that.
Sorry,
said Lincoln, looking crestfallen. The Doctor looked at the worried and expectant faces of the passengers.
Look, he began.
For their comfort and safety, transit clients are encouraged to return to the executive salon of Novilunar Corporation's interstitial transposition vehicle.
Sugar interrupted in a clear, projecting voice. She was coyly indicating the way, using safety demonstration gestures.
A complimentary at-seat snack and beverage service will be available, while Novilunar makes the most strenuous efforts possible to correct this transit error and return you all to your normal quantum state. Mediating your comfort is our business, and our business is Novilunar business.
Everyone was looking at her.
So get back on the freaking ship now, Mr. Anders, and all the rest of you, Sugar growled. Let the doctor save your lives from a fate so nasty you don't even want to know about it. Move! Scoot!
Everyone obediently began to hurry towards the seating lounge exit.
Additional information can be found on the laminated card in your seat back pouch, Sugar called after them.
The doctor grinned at her. Sugar McCauley, I could kiss you, he said.
Not stopping you, she replied.
Doctor, Lincoln Tang said.
Yes?
I hear voices.
The voices were getting closer. Sugar, Lincoln and the doctor led the anxious passengers out of the seating area and back across the terminal station's vast concourse towards the ship. The sky above seemed to be bruised with light. A stale white glare filled the concourse. A breeze had picked up, blowing grit and litter around. Voices screamed from far away. The Follow Me sped after the advancing party, dragging the reluctant Luck Dog by its lead.
Someone just said my name, Mrs. Westlake said.
And mine, exclaimed Charles Anders.
Nothing to worry about, the doctor announced. It's just an auditory interstitial echo. A side effect of transposition. Pay no attention.
It isn't, is it, Doctor? Sugar whispered.
No, he admitted.
It's how the entities lock onto us. It's how they target us. They learn our names.
Ah, she said.
What's the matter? He asked.
I keep hearing something saying my name too, she said. They've got us all targeted, haven't they?
I won't let them get you, Sugar, he said.
I believe you, she replied, smiling back at him bravely. I'm relying on you now, you understand?
Oh, totally, he said.
The crowd of passengers reached the red carpet and followed it to the foot of the landing tower steps.
Oh, that's not good, Lincoln cried out.
He was pointing. A spinning ball of mercury and glass was forming about 3 meters away from the tower's base.
There's another one, Mrs. Westlake exclaimed.
A second entity was extruding into the wavelength close to the red carpet.
Someone just said my name, Lincoln cried out.
There's another one,
Charles Anders yelled. The doctor turned. Dozens of spinning glass forms were appearing across the concourse, slowly fusing and coalescing into entities.
Up the steps, everybody, he yelled. Sugar, Millie, get everyone into their seats. And this time it's got to be their original seats, the ones they were in when they started.
He shuddered. A shocked expression crossed his face.
What's the matter?
Sugar asked as she ushered people past onto the steps.
Someone just said my name, said the doctor.
What? The doctor? Big deal.
No, he said. My name. My actual name. I didn't think there was anyone left in the entire universe who knew what it was. Except for me.
They're targeting you?
I'm right in their crosshairs, he said. They're coming to stop me before I spoil everything for them.
Millie and Sugar scrambled the passengers up the tower and into the vehicle. As they got them seated, the doctor slammed the hatch shut with Lincoln's help. The jarring cries of the phantom voices were unpleasantly piercing. There was a gritty smell in the air, a baked dust smell of dead realities.
What happens now?
Lincoln asked excitedly. You get to your seat, the doctor told him.
But I want to be part of the fun, Lincoln protested.
This isn't going to be fun, yelled the doctor. Go!
Lincoln ran. The doctor hurried towards the flight deck of the interstitial transposition vehicle. It was as he and Sugar had left it. The main screen was just showing a blinking cursor symbol. The doctor flopped into the command seat and activated pre-transit checks. He called up the engine ignition protocols and set them to the specific quantum frequency that he'd calculated from their command center data. There was a rumble as the transposition engines began to cycle from a cold start. Responding to automatic preconditions, the pink glow around the edges of the windows started up again.
Come on, said the doctor. Come on, let's go!
The engine tone began to increase. Joseph Stern's Cluxton's transposition engines began to cycle up to the wavelength that the doctor had set. The doctor held his finger over the cutoff switch. As soon as they reached the correct frequency and realigned with reality, he could kill the engines. But he could hear something calling his name, lisping his name through alien maws too full of teeth. He looked up. A silvery ball of glass and light appeared in the left-hand part of the flight deck. An entity was beginning to form. The doctor got out of his seat. A second entity was extruding its glassy way into his universe directly to his right. The left-hand one already had limbs growing. It lashed out at him, hoping to touch him. The doctor threw himself flat, ducking. The flailing limb struck a seat back and disintegrated it.
The flight deck was no longer a safe place to be. The entities moved towards him. The doctor darted for the executive salon.
"What's happening now?"
Jay Sylvian asked tremulously as the doctor rushed past her along the aisle.
"I'll just find out,"
Sugar replied and turned to race after the doctor.
"Doctor!"
"What?" he yelled over his shoulder as he ran through the vehicle's aft service space towards the engineering compartment.
"What's happening?"
Sugar shouted, chasing him. "They're closing in on me," he replied, not breaking step. "They're trying to stop me." The transposition engines were grumbling, their rhythm rising. The sound of screaming voices was deafening. Something was calling Sugar's name over and over. Her name and someone else's. The doctor skidded to a halt at the iris hatch that led into the engine compartment.
"They know me now," he said. "I have their full attention."
He looked in through the compartment hatch. The engines were now singing to themselves. He listened and smiled.
"What?"
she asked. He raised a finger indicating that she should wait for a moment. There was a tiny little jolt.
"We just hit the right wavelength," he said in quiet triumph.
"We just bumped back." "We have?" Sugar asked. "Go upstairs and I think you'll find a full complement of transfer clients restored," said the doctor.
"You're back in your home reality, Sugar McCauley."
"But what about," she began.
"The hard part? I was just getting to that."
He stepped through the hatch into the compartment and immediately recoiled. Three entities were lurking in the workspace between the engine shells. They turned to block him. They were virtually fully formed. Dark shadow predators that would tear reality apart if they got the chance. Their mouths were wide and full of teeth.
"They're not going to let me get at the engines," the doctor said. "Just a quick blast of my screwdriver on the right frequency would be enough to disrupt the engine cycle and send them into a safety shutdown. But those things won't let me get close enough."
He looked at her.
"Never mind. I have another idea," he said.
The luck dog was yapping furiously in her arms. Sugar tried to shush it. It was hard to hold on to the small, struggling animal and bend down and adjust the Follow Me's command settings.
"Done! It's done, Doctor!" she cried.
The loyal little artificial lurched away from her and scooted through the engine compartment hatch. As soon as it had trundled past him, the Doctor leapt out from behind the hatch cover and waved at the entities in the compartment.
"Hey, hello! Looking for me?"
he shouted. They saw him and moved forward. They didn't pay any regard to the small artificial rolling across the floor. They didn't know its name. The doctor's sonic screwdriver was strapped in the Follow Me's hopper with a diamante leash. The screwdriver was set for a 10-second burst. The bump was more considerable this time. It felt like the ship had properly crashed. Sugar and the doctor were both knocked off their feet and sirens began to wail. Emergency lights flashed. The engines made a terrible, uncomfortable noise and then shut down. The entities, now right at the compartment hatch, stopped moving. They trembled for a moment. Then they shattered like glass, the tumbling fragments vanished, and they were excluded from standard reality forever. The doctor helped Sugar to her feet.
"There," he said.
"Teamwork."
There was pandemonium in the executive salon.
"Sugar, Sugar, baby, I thought we'd lost you,"
Lizzie yelled when Sugar appeared.
"Loads of people just vanished, and then they came back, and I think we've crashed."
Sugar returned the barking luck dog to the Dowager Colette, then gave Lizzie a hug.
"It's so good to see you," she said.
Over Lizzie's shoulder, Sugar could see Cluxton and his entourage. Cluxton looked apoplectic.
"Where's Bortnick?"
he was yelling.
"Where's Bortnick?"
"I'd see if you can calm him down a bit," Sugar told Lizzie. "He's having a bad day. His career's just taken a bit of a dent."
"Has it?"
Lizzie asked.
"I don't think this craft is going into service after all.
Safety issues." Sugar left Lizzie in charge and headed for the boarding hatch. As she left the executive salon, she saw Jay Sylvian hugging her husband as if she was never going to let him go. The doctor met her at the hatch and they opened it together.
Where have you been? She asked.
Well, he said, I know the Empire won't pursue transposition technology after this, but just to be on the safe side.
What did you do?
I made sure the engines won't work again any time soon. They opened the hatch.
Outside, crowds were cheering and flags were waving. Support and rescue services were approaching the landing tower.
Look, said the doctor. It's everybody.
He gestured towards the city.
Eternity Terminal Station, he said. The end of the line. Everybody out.
He took her by the hand and led her down the steps.
Well, now we're here. What does the future hold for Sugar McCauley? The doctor asked.
You've been there, she said. You tell me.
He grinned. Well, I've just got to go and check on something, he said, indicating the ship behind them. I left something in one of the provision stores.
He gently straightened her chrome-winged helmet.
That really is a brilliant hat, he said.
Sugar stood at the hatch and waited as the support teams rushed up.
I'm fine, honestly, she said to a worried medical technician. Go check on the transfer clients.
I really am fine, she thought. It would take her many months to get back to Earth using conventional travel, but it would be good to go home. Sugar thought she might visit her auntie in the Toronto Tower. She went back inside the interstitial transposition vehicle to help with the commotion. The Follow Me trundled after her.
I gotta do something to fix your programming, haven't I? She said to it.
Then something caught her attention. She blinked and connected a speech link to Lizzie in the salon.
Hey, Lizzie, she said. It's Sugar. Have you any idea how to turn the flickery pink glow off?
The doctor found the TARDIS where he'd left her in Provision Store 3, safe and sound and as welcoming as ever. As he went inside, he paused on the threshold and looked back into the shadows of the storeroom. Sugar hadn't even asked him who the creatures were or where they had come from. Good job, really, as he just didn't know. Sometimes it happened like that. Sometimes he found himself battling against forces he never got to identify or even meet.
Still, you couldn't know everything at once, could you?
Perhaps he'd encounter them again one day. He hoped not, though.
But then, who could say what lay in store for him or anyone else? As long as there was fun, adventure and learning involved, he was ready to face it.
With a final grin at the shadows, he went into the TARDIS and on into the great unknown.
Doctor Who, The Last Voyage, was written by Dan Abnett and read by David Tennant, and is published by BBC Audiobooks.
BBC Audiobooks now present a unique glimpse into the last days of pirate radio in the 1960s. Incredibly, this recording was found at the bottom of the sea, in the recently discovered wreck of one such floating radio station. It has been carefully restored, thanks to the work of archivist James Goss, and is now played here for the very first time. Due to the age of the recording, the sound quality may vary.
Hello, I'm the Doctor. And if you can hear this, then one of us is going to die.
If I'm lucky, you're listening to this on the boat, looking out at the sea and the gulls. Lots of gulls. Of course, if I'm not lucky, you're listening to this somewhere else. Perhaps even at home. In which case, it's too late. It's already escaped. And it's the end of the world. Of course, I didn't realize that when I arrived on the boat. The first thing I saw was Layla, trying to make toast in the dark. Hello, I said, watching as she bashed the toaster against the counter repeatedly. Hiya, she muttered, and carried on pounding the toaster. It's not going to work, I said. She looked at me sharply. She was as beautiful then as she is now. Short, cropped blonde hair, black and white patterned dress, and a red majorette's jacket crammed on top. Why not, Chuck? She asked, crossly. I shrugged. Power cut, I explained. Oh, she sighed, dropping the toaster. It's my turn to DJ. I'm supposed to be on air, but the transmitter's gone down, so there's nothing else to do. I always like toast in a crisis. I knew how she felt. Allow me, I said, and aimed a blast of the sonic screwdriver at the toaster. Showing off, I know, but within seconds, two slices of toast popped out into her hands. I mean, okay, strictly speaking, they're not toasted. I've simply sonically stimulated the sugar molecules into caramelization, but... Layla looked around for a knife, and not finding one, grabbed the sonic screwdriver and energetically buttered her toast with it. Then she sat, cross-legged, watching me intently. It was then that I realized we were rocking gently backwards and forwards. I looked at her. Boat? I asked. She nodded between mouthfuls. I thought. She'd said transmitter. 60s clothes, 1966. It's the Bobbles, dead giveaway. And she'd said boat. And boat meant... Pirate radio station? I asked. In the 60s, the United Kingdom had been circled by a flotilla of boats, illegally blasting pop music into the ears of teenagers, until the BBC relented and gave them what they wanted. Oh, yeah. Kind of like the Dunkirk of pop. She nodded and wiped some crumbs from her mouth. And you are? I spread my arms expansively. They call me the Doctor, I said. I'm your new DJ. Come to chill out those cats. No, she smirked and shook her head. For one thing, no DJ ever sounded like you, pet. For another, we'd have felt your arrival. If the tugboat pulls up, it bumps into the ship. The needle jumps off the record being played on air, and everyone knows. Plus, the tug only comes on Tuesdays, and today is... Not Tuesday? I guessed. She shook her head again, straightened out her skirt, and slid onto the kitchen lino. Not even close. So who are you, and why are you here? Just this once. I figured I may as well tell her the truth. I was here, hunting the hush. It was a weapon. A weapon used in a great war. The hush existed to consume noise and anything that made noise. It was ruthlessly effective at homing in on and wiping out its enemies, who loved nothing other than to make noise, screaming robotic commands at each other and the universe in general. The problem was that this hush had missed its target and had just torn on through space and time. I'd only just become aware of it, frantically trailing after it, following the devastation it left behind. I had to stop it. And it had come here, to Earth. And, said Layla, she was coping very well with the whole time and space and not human thing. I should give out badges for that. Well, it's here, on your boat, and I've got to stop it before it kills again.
And what's it like?
Oh, it doesn't have a physical form. It's just a ball of vicious noise. It's not intelligent, just nasty, loud and cunning.
Right, said Layla. I used to have a boss like that. That was when I decided working in a shop wasn't for me, which is how I became a DJ.
I nodded.
And you're really from outer space?
Yep.
Cool.
And you don't have a problem with that? Layla shrugged.
When you've met the Beatles, nothing surprises you. Although...
Yeah.
Nah, it's okay. I can ask later.
I checked my watch. No, go on.
How come you're dressed like you work in a bank? Shouldn't you have a tinfoil suit?
Ah, chafes.
I see,
she said, finishing the last of her toast.
Now, this hush thing you're hunting, well, what's the worst that can happen?
I gestured out of the window. Where's that?
Oh, she said, Frinton.
Well, I admitted, I'm here to save the world. Failing that, Frinton. I'd been on the outer edges of the solar system when I'd realized where it was heading. This one unlucky little radio station. Little Radio Bravo, with its transmitter beaming its signal at just the wrong angle to attract the attention of the Hush, calling it to Earth. Chasing after it, I'd heard them all. The smooth tones of DJ Jasper.